Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Pudge Kleinkopf, and she'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing for Alaska's Arctic grayling. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Pudge a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Pudge Kleinkopf about fly fishing for Alaska's Arctic grayling. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like shortline nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce Pudge, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com. Look for the link under Pudge's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Pudge's latest book, which is Fly Fishing Alaska's Arctic Grayling, courtesy of Amato Books. And if you'd like to see more about what Amato Books has to offer, you can go to AmatoBooks.com, AmatoBooks.com. So thanks to them, we'll be giving away Pudge's book, and here's how you can win it. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. Now, the question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, and be fast about it, and you might win Pudge's book. Tonight our guest is Pudge Kleinkopf. Pudge is a retired university professor and lawyer, a longtime fly fisher, and has owned and operated women's fly fishing for 20 years. She offers lodge-based fly fishing schools and a small group guided trips throughout Alaska for salmon, trout, grayling, char, and pike. She also leads saltwater fly fishing trips to Mexico each year and offers a fly fishing school in conjunction with the John Campbell Folk School in North Carolina. Pudge took the winning sailfish in the 2005 Sails and Tails Fly Fishing Tournament in Zihuatanejo, Mexico, and is scheduled to lead a fly fishing school for women's in Swedish Lapland in 2006. She served on the pro staff for Mustad Hooks, Ross Reels, and Patagonia. Pudge is a regular presenter and fly tire at outdoor shows in Alaska, California, and Washington. She's been featured in the Anchorage Daily News and is one of the special explorers for Alaska's magazine television series on PBS. And she's a board member of the International Women's Fly Fishers. Pudge is the author of Fly Fishing Women Explore Alaska, River Girls, Fly Fishing for Young Women, and Fly Fishing for Alaska's Arctic Grayling. She also serves as a contributing editor to Fish Alaska magazine. Pudge, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
I'm glad to be here. I'm delighted to be here, Roger. Thanks for inviting me again.
Well, good, good. Glad to have you. And see if we can explore Alaska's Arctic grayling. We talked about it a bit in your other show, and we talked about all the different fish in Alaska. But tonight we're going to dig in and see if we can pry out all your detailed information that you know about this wonderful, beautiful fish that Alaska holds so dearly. So let's get going. We'll talk about the fish first, and let's start it out with a great question by Martin Coleman of Lawrence, Kansas. And he says, what makes fishing for Arctic grayling so exciting to you?
Well, everyone, and Martin, thanks for the question. Arctic grayling has become, over the 42 years now that I've lived in Alaska, it has become far and away my favorite fish. It's exciting because it's interesting. It's a very, very unique fish. It's also a very, very cooperative fish, which endears it, as you might guess, to fly fishers everywhere. But it's also, as far as I'm concerned, the most beautiful fish that swims. It won't fight as long as a big, nice rainbow trout, but the saying on Arctic grayling is they fight fiercely for their size. So there's no more perfect fish, as far as I'm concerned, for a 5-weight rod than Arctic grayling.
Now, maybe you can, and I know in your book you did this rather nicely and took several pages, actually, to do it, but can you describe what a grayling looks like and, you know, the special features that it has?
Well, I'm actually going to talk about this. Well, first, it's a unique fish in many of its characteristics, and it's hard to describe it in words. It's a fish that you must really see to appreciate, and you must see it underwater with the light glinting on its scales to really understand what it is that is so breathtakingly beautiful about this fish. Well, in the book, I said, words like exquisite, ethereal, graceful, delicate, mystical are used when describing grayling. Unfortunately, even a surfeit of objectives like these proves inadequate to the task. Mere words simply cannot satisfactorily convey the glistening scales of an Arctic grayling that brighten in the reflected light, the graceful flare of that indescribable fin, or the huge golden-rimmed sable eyes, shaped like a perfect teardrop, that contemplate us with an ancient wisdom. There's something about a grayling that is, I mean, it's very special. Its color is often a beautiful aqua color, but at times the scales can glint almost a purple color. Some in certain waters, based on both what they're eating and the nature of the, you know, the bottom and the environment, they can be golden as well. But their most unique feature, and the one that is always talked about first on Arctic grayling, is their dorsal fin. They have pretty much almost an outsized dorsal fin in comparison to a very sleek, kind of brownish-tinged body. Their scales are cichlid scales, and that's the explanation for why the light refraction makes them so incredibly beautiful. But it's really the fin that just dazzles everybody. No two fins are the same. They're high. Many of them are long and pointed. There, some of them are so long that the point of the fin kind of droops over the end of the body right in front of the tail. And often when they're courting or fighting us, the fin is always raised to its full height. Many people have referred to it as sail-like, and that's why the subtitle of the book is called The Sailfish Grayling Are Considered the Sailfish of the North. But I always liken it to a fan that you think of in my book, and I say that it reminds me of the unfurling of the fan of a beautiful woman at a masquerade, because the fin absolutely transforms them. They're just, so I say that you just can't believe it until you actually see one. But it's also the combination of all the other fins are also, they're striped, they're dotted, some of them have orange spots. The grayling fin, the dorsals, often have a kind of a reddish-orange band around the top of the fin that's very evident when the fin is unfurled. And the color of the body goes clear, starting at their gill plate, will be a beautiful aqua. Their sides will be aqua, and the color will extend clear out to the tail. So it's the beauty of the fin, but also the eyes. It's really the eyes that get me. No other fish that I fish for kind of looks at me like they do, or at least I, you know, I believe that they do. And so I really love the eyes. Now, the spots that grayling have on their sides are also a very unique feature of them. Andy Griska, who helped me write the book, he was my biological consultant, we talked long and hard, he and I, about the spots. No two sets of spots on two different grayling are the same. You could look at 100 bazillion grayling, and the spots, all of the spots would be unique. And Andy says that biologists characterize the spots as a grayling's fingerprints. So it's sort of the combination of all of those three things that I think makes the grayling just, I call it a showstopper of a fish to watch and to fish for.
Yeah, it really is. I know when I've caught grayling, there's something different when you bring it to you and trying to unhook it and hold it in your hand. You just kind of look at it and just kind of wonder.
You can't help but look at it.
Yeah. It's like you wish you could look at it longer, but you've got to get it going.
Yes, that's exactly right. It's like, and no picture ever does the fish justice. Michael DeYoung, who's been the photographer now for all three of my books, and it's really Mike's photography that really brings the book to life. Without Mike's photographs, I could use, again, 100 bazillion words to describe grayling, and I never could do it adequately, but Mike's photos do an incredible job of showing you this beautiful fish.
Yeah, he does have some nice ones. He took some nice ones that are included in your book. Is a grayling a relative of trout or salmon?
No. Many people believe that they are, but they are species of their own. Thymelis arcticus is their scientific name, but better known as Arctic grayling. And the story goes, they were named by a scientist, a biologist, many, many, many years ago, who was responsible for the naming of many species of fish. Pallas, I believe, is his last name. And he was said to have encountered the Arctic grayling in Russia on a trip there, and thus the name Arctic grayling came from those encounters on his part. So, no, they are their own species.
And what is their life cycle? I mean, a lot of us are familiar with the trout and the salmon in Alaska and what they do, but what do the grayling do for their activities and so forth?
As you know, we'll talk, I'm sure, all of tonight about, you know, what makes them unique in many ways. And one of certainly of their aspects of their uniqueness is their life cycle. First of all, they are pretty much the slowest growing of all the sport fish. And that's a fact that many people aren't really aware of when it comes to grayling. A few years back, about 2007 or 8, I believe, the biologists doing a tagging study were, with several different aging techniques, discovered one fish with a tag that was really, we say, only 18 inches long, which is actually considered trophy size for Arctic grayling, but it was only 18 inches long, and after they did, I think, 3 or 4 different aging techniques on the fish turned out to be over 30 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, that's a pretty old fish, but yet it's not a huge fish. Now, that's apparently thanks to the fact that the environment that it lives in is so harsh and so demanding and so difficult to survive in that all of those factors contribute to the fact that they are very slow growing. Now, they're spring spawners, and what makes that especially unique as far as grayling are concerned is when you think about they spend 6 months under the ice in the winter. So they go into like hibernation, essentially, in the late fall and spend the winter in their kind of, like fish do, suspended animation, under the ice for 6 months, the female holding the eggs in her body and the male holding the milk in his. So as soon as the ice is out, and they're studying now what triggers them to move out of the areas where, you know, winter over and into the areas where they spawn. And in many cases, they find that their travel back, their journey back to where they are going to spawn, begins for many of them even under the ice. So, but then I always sort of imagine in my head, here's these small, feisty fish fighting their way through ice floes and, you know, rotting ice on the river while they're battling upstream, and it's when they get to their spawning beds, they spawn virtually immediately. The males always, as far as they know, get to the spawning beds first and then sort of, you know, battle with each other while they're waiting for the ladies to arrive. And then spawning takes place quite quickly. And the other very unique, I mean, there's just one thing after the other with them is part of what fascinates me. So they don't dig a nest. They're one of the few fish that does not, I mean, freshwater fish, that does not kind of dig some sort of a nest for its eggs. Instead, the eggs are simply broadcast out over the gravel and the sand, and they're sticky so that they stick, they're meant to stick kind of to the sand. And once spawning is over, both the male and the female leave virtually immediately for the feeding areas because they haven't got a very long, you know, period of time to feed and to build back up, you know, their strength and the development of the eggs and the milk again for the following season. So the eggs, if the water is high, the egg production of the year may be dismal because the flood water will wash much of them away. At the same time, if the water is very low, the eggs, you know, don't actually, many of them die because there's not enough, like, agitation and oxygenation in the water for them. So that whole spawning thing that they do, I describe in my book, I actually once was able to see them spawn. I had planned it, and it was way before I knew what I know now of grayling. But it was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. The male, with his huge dorsal fin, chooses his mate. They move kind of separately in pairs, and as they mate, his fin flares and essentially covers her as they are next to each other. And I thought it was the most beautiful, you know, pairing of fish that I have ever seen. But then, as I say, quickly, these little guys are on their own because mommy and daddy have, you know, headed off. They've got to eat. And so the babies, there's a wonderful expression that's in the book that someone coined many, many years ago, saying that the little salmon, a little grayling fry, look like two eyeballs on a thread. And they are almost pretty much invisible to the naked eye. But early on in their life, they grow fairly quickly. But it takes between 6 and 7 years, usually, to grow a fish that is even 12 inches long. So from there, they grow fairly quickly until reproduction, they're able to reproduce, many of them, shortly after they achieve about 12 to 14 inches, somewhere in there. And so once they're able to reproduce, then the speed of their growth slows because they need to spend so much of their energy developing the eggs and the milt in their body. But still, an 18-inch fish is considered a trophy.
Yeah, that's the size of the last one I caught, in fact.
Good for you.
I wasn't even fishing for grayling.
You know, Roger, that's what happens many, many times. That's the way many anglers are introduced to Arctic grayling, is they catch one while they're fishing for something else, particularly people who come from, we call it the lower 48. That's often the way they become acquainted with grayling.
Yeah. Now, when they do spawn, is this in small feeder creeks or
Yes,
lakes?
Generally it's small water that, you know, has enough flow to oxygenate the eggs, but not a lot of flow because these eggs are, I forget the statistic actually in the book, but they're less than half the size of a trout egg.
Okay.
So they're tiny, tiny little eggs.
Yeah. We did have a question from Joanne and St. Louis Obispo, California, she said, and this is about the aging thing, but she says, how long does it take for an Arctic grayling to reach maybe 12 inches? Now, you said that can maybe happen in a few years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, somebody told her 30 years, but I suppose a 12-incher could be 30 years old as well, right?
No, probably not. Not a 12.
Okay.
Maybe a 17 or 16 or 17 or 18 might be, but not a 12. Probably what happened there was that someone had been made aware of the study that revealed the 18-inch fish that was 30 years old and may have just, you know, mixed up those two things. But they can be very old fish. And, you know, they really don't know the oldest fish. I mean, conceivably, they could live 40 years. But when you fish a lot for them and see them, you get so you can tell the old ones. They're dark. You can see they're battle-scarred from spawning and from the kinds of trips they have to make, you know, to their wintering grounds and back, you know, and being caught and, you know, being bit by salmon, you know, as they follow the salmon. So, you know, they look their age, most of them.
Okay. Question from Jonathan in Oak Harbor, Washington asks, what's an average size grayling and what is a really big grayling?
Well, an average size grayling, Jonathan, kind of depends on what river you're fishing in. But if you kind of cumulatively, you know, thought about all of it around Alaska, probably people would say an average is just between 12 and maybe 14 or 15 inches.
Okay.
But now, the large fish, just recently, in 2008, a fellow from England who fishes Alaska a lot set a new state record and a new IGFA record on 6-pound test for Arctic grayling. And the fish that set the new record was 23 inches long and 5 pounds 1 inch in weight. So that will give you an idea. Most people consider really big fish, a big grayling, are when you get into 20 inches or more.
Yeah, okay. Question online that came in from Lane in California. He says, are they hydronomous or are they only stay in fresh water for their life?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I never thought they were anadromous, and they are never thought to be anadromous. But as I was researching the book, I nearly fell off my chair one day when I came across, actually thanks to Andy, a small study in, I think it was Bosnian. Anyway, it's up in, you know, like Sweden and Norway and Denmark and that area. And there's a bay up there where they discovered grayling, one group or race of grayling that was considered to be semi-anadromous, in that they actually moved into freshwater. It was still fairly brackish, but it was mostly freshwater to actually spawn, and then as soon as they spawned, they returned back to the brackish water in this bay. And I'd never heard of such a thing. So Andy and I then talked about it one day, and he said, well now, Pudge, he said, there are some of the grayling populations way up on the North Slope in Alaska that he said they have to temporarily spend a little while in brackish water, because there's one of the charts in my book from the north, from the Arctic Slope. And he said as they move out of their feeding river and over to their wintering river, he said they actually go out into like brackish water for a while and can survive there for a while and then move back into fresh water to, you know, spend the winter. So I think still the general answer, probably the answer, is they're not anadromous. They don't really know that they're anadromous now, but just the fact that a little population like this, and the fact that Andy says that some of the populations on the North Slope here actually do move into and can survive in brackish water for a while, suggests that there might be a new category of anadromous. I found that absolutely fascinating.
Well, the world changes.
It does. And you know they're discovering more and more species and subspecies of grayling all the time. Andy says the research is just booming now.
Well, Pudge, we need to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk more about the Arctic grayling.
Yes, we will.
Hang with us, folks.
Okay.
Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Pudge Kleinkopf about fly fishing for Alaska's Arctic grayling. If you'd like to ask Pudge a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many as possible on the show tonight. Well, Pudge, obviously, last year you were finishing up this book, but I always like to ask my guests, what's going on in your fly fishing world? I know you've got a business up there, and what's happening?
Well, this coming year, this coming summer, will be my 26th year in business. My business is known as Women's Fly Fishing, and I do small group guided trips all around Alaska. I do 12 different trips throughout the summer in Alaska, and those trips are for both women and couples. Even though my original name of my business was Women's Fly Fishing, that was so that I could help women get started. More and more women now are fly fishing. And so the last few years, I also have incorporated trips where I can do women and couples on the trips. So we go to 12 locations around Alaska during the summer, and then, as you indicated earlier, we go off to Mexico in April, And then as of the last 3 years now, I've also been taking groups to Argentina. So that way I have a couple of things that keep me fishing in the winter. Argentina's in January and April is Mexico. So I've been doing that. I continue to write for Fish Alaska Magazine. I'm about to start work on a new book for Amato Publications. Let's see. I'm one of the founders, actually, for the Casting for Recovery program in Alaska, and I still help with that, you know, as one of the instructors and, you know, people who help raise money and make Casting for Recovery a phenomena. And I had been scheduled this coming year to co-lead a trip for the International Women Fly Fishers in Scotland. They're called Gatherings. A couple every year to the International Women Fly Fishers puts on an event in a country outside of the United States to help fly fishing women to get together. So one was planned for this June, late June and early July in Scotland, but unfortunately the woman who was to co-lead that with me, Leslie Crawford, a very, very famous Scottish, primarily stillwater trout fisher, has just recently died. So my plan for this summer, that won't be happening. But I'm sure I'll find other fishing to do, even though I'm going to miss Scotland, having been there before. So as you mentioned earlier, our Swedish trip, we went again last year to Sweden and had an incredibly successful trip. So maybe again next year or two. So I managed to keep busy with all of that.
I guess. So. That's pretty busy to me.
Winters are still long in Alaska.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. Well, good. Good. Well, thanks for sharing that with us. Well, let's get back and talk about the grayling. We do have a question from George in Gadsden, Alabama. He says, why are graylings so slimy? So the grizzlies can't hold on to them, or just the fishermen?
Well, actually, George, I really don't find grayling as slimy as most fish. And I think that's though because they have, you know, the cichlid scales, which, you know, most freshwater fish don't. But actually, you know, the grizzlies don't go after them anyway because they can't get them. The grayling are too fast. You know, grizzlies really only go after the salmon. They can't get the trout. They can't get the char. They can't get the grayling. Those fish are just too fast for them. So I think it's just that maybe some anglers find them as slimy.
Okay. A myth, we'll call it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, yeah. We've got a question from Kyle in Anchorage, your neck of the woods. Do you have a favorite time or season to fish the interior streams and lakes for grayling?
Well, you can pretty much start fishing for grayling, you know, as soon as the ice is out. But I say they're sometimes a little harder to cooperate then, mostly because, you know, they've just finished spawning, or, you know, they're just still kind of moving around in some of the feeder streams until they kind of settle down, you know, in an area where they're going to be feeding. But then you can fish them all season and into the fall, and in many rivers, quite late into the fall. But one of the stories in my book that, you know, I had to tell people was, actually it was only late August, and we did a trip, we took the four-wheelers up to a small creek that I'd been wanting to fish for quite a while in interior Alaska, and we got, I think, two fish all day. And as we had lunch, we were sitting thinking, what's going on here? Because the fellow who had guided us on the four-wheelers said, I was just up here a couple weeks ago. He said, they were grayling all over the place. Well, what had happened, we finally concluded, was that they had had a couple of hard frosts up in that, it was quite high, up in that area. And that, as far as we could tell, the fish had already begun to move back down into the lower river and start their migrating back for the winter. But as far as I'm concerned, as long as you can find them in the fall, you can fish them.
And
they can be very aggressive in the fall, too, because, you know, they're just like all fish. They're bulking up for,
sure,
you know, for the wintering over.
Now, so there's no legal season?
No, generally not. Now, you do have to watch the regulations. There's certainly regulations in many places around the state that limit the number of fish that you can take. And in some cases, you know, also like the whole, you know, barbless kind of thing. But
right.
I mean, as soon as you can find them and as late as you can find them, you can fish for them.
Okay. Now, are they found throughout Alaska?
No. Now, that's a myth that just persists. And, you know, when I first came and fell in love with grayling, I thought they were all over the state. I mean, and to hear many people talk about it, you would think they were. But Southeast Alaska has virtually none. Kodiak Island has virtually none, and the Aleutian Chain has virtually none. The biologists, well, they have several theories about why that is, but mostly it sounds to me like they're saying that the water is simply not cold enough for them. But now, many people say, but wait, I fished for grayling in this lake near Juneau. You might have done that. Those are not native fish. They're planted fish.
Okay.
So there are, and I know on Kodiak, there's a few in, like, the Cordova area. There's a couple of small lakes where they plant grayling. In the 50s, apparently, there was a big effort in the state of Alaska to, you know, try to transplant a lot of different species, you know, by the Department of Fish and Game. But the people that I know in the Department of Fish and Game say that most of the river plants didn't take. Some of the lake plants did take. And again, when I was researching the book, I seemed to find that as a kind of a fairly common thing, that it was the fluvial plantings that were pretty much unsuccessful. And I don't know that anyone has analyzed too much why not, but it was, you know, the fluvial grayling live in rivers, live and spawn in rivers. The lacustrine grayling live and spawn all in lakes. And then there's a third kind of grayling that's called adfluvial, and those are grayling that live in lakes, but they go out of the lake to spawn in tributaries. And so apparently a lot of these fish stocking programs were only successful for the lacustrine strain that both lives and spawns in lakes. And that's true in the lower 48 as well.
Right, I think grayling, in Colorado we have like maybe two lakes that have grayling.
Uh-huh.
And they're high mountain lakes above 10,000 feet, very cold.
Yes.
You know,
again, see, because of the cold. Yeah. They need cold weather. If the temperature gets anywhere near 60 degrees, the big guys are gone. I mean, some of the baby fish, you know, may be around, or the, you know, two-year-olds or something, but not the big fish. Not the big fish. They want water as cold and pure as possible. Also, when the rivers or water gets the least polluted, they're gone.
So they're sensitive to pollution, yeah.
Very much so, okay. Yes.
Now, if you were going for a trophy grayling, what part of Alaska would you go to? Any particular area?
Well, you would go to, Bristol Bay has a lot of streams. That story's in the book. We fished many years ago. We rafted a tributary to the Togiak River, and we caught many fish well over, 20 inches, 23, 24, 25-inch fish in, you know, a small river that was a tributary to Togiak. And many people believe that there are fish way beyond what is the new state record and IGFA record, and then the IGFA all-tackle record comes from Canada. But there's many people believe and indicate that they have actually caught fish larger than both the all-tackle record and the fly-tackle record for grayling in Bristol Bay. So many, many rivers in Bristol Bay, and that's in
the
section of the book, yeah, that's the biggest kind of section about, you know, where to look. But also, the Seward Peninsula, Kotzebue, Nome, Unalakleet, rivers up in there also have very big grayling.
Well, that's the last one I caught I was talking about was in a creek off of Togiak.
Off of the Togiak. Uh-huh,
yeah.
Togiak's a nice river. It's a nice, nice rafting river, too. Yeah.
Yeah, great river to float, yeah. Okay, Pete Gramp in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. I know you focus in Alaska, but where are grayling found outside of Alaska? Is Alaska the only place that you can fish for these gems in North America?
Well, no, Pete. First, if you got to consider Canada and North America, too. So it's really Alaska and Canada. I mean, that's where the native grayling are. Now, once upon a time, in record show, there were grayling in Wisconsin and I think Minnesota, and two or three of the Great Lakes states, and also, as many people know, in Montana. But all of those populations now in the Great Lakes are gone. You may still find some grayling, but they will be grayling that have been planted. They may be wild grayling, and you know, a wild fish is simply a planted fish that now has established itself in the wild and reproduces in the wild. But a true native fish is the one that, you know, was always there. And so there's a tiny, tiny population, I forget now, it's 25 fish or something, in one of the rivers in Montana that the Department of Fish and Game and residents of Montana are trying very hard to get protected status for from the federal government as an endangered species. But so far, they haven't been entirely successful. But those are, there's a tiny, tiny population there still of native fish. But so having said that, Pete, and for other people who are listening who are not in Canada or Alaska, there's many states that plant grayling. And as Roger just was saying, primarily they plant them in high mountain lakes where, and because, as I say, the lacustrine grayling will survive better planting than the others, and it's because mostly it's the temperature and the purity of the water, they believe, that, you know, enables those grayling to live there. But grayling are a very delicate and a very sensitive fish to their environment.
Well, I know we've got a couple of questions here, James in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and Jonathan in Oak Harbor, Washington, both asking about where to find grayling close to them. What would you suggest they do? Because I know you don't know state by state where these fish exist, but what would you suggest to them to help
well,
them find
certainly the area? The easiest way to be would be to call your Department of Fish and Game and ask, you know, go to the Sport Fish Division, and then just say, I'm trying to find out if any grayling, and just refer to them as grayling, have been planted in any of the lakes or rivers that are open to fishing. I'd like to fish for them. You know, are there any? And I'm sure that those states, I mean, it seems like someone told me that, like, Arizona's got a couple of lakes in high lakes and stuff. And you're right. I know Colorado does, and I know a few others of the, like, probably still lake states have. But I would just say call your Department of Fish and Game and talk to one of the fisheries biologists and, you know, find out. You could probably Google it, too. I mean, Google your state, you know, fish and fisheries and see what pops up.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Larry in Baldwin, Michigan asks if you compare Alaska and Yukon Arctic grayling, are they basically the same and do the fisheries differ?
Well, the fish are both Arctic grayling. There's another species of grayling we'll just probably get to here a little later. But Arctic grayling are the fish that are native to Alaska and, or most of Alaska, and most of Canada. So at anywhere that they exist in Canada, and as I said, remember, there aren't any really planted, there's a few in Alaska in a few lakes, and I'm sure that's true in Canada as well. But the native fish, they're will be essentially the same fish. And it's like any species, you know, there'll be certain populations that, you know, may take on a different coloration or, you know, may have, you know, more spot patterns or something or, you know, than others. But they're both still Arctic grayling. But, you know, not having fished for grayling in Canada, you know, I can't really tell you. But, I mean, they are the same species there.
Okay. Nick in London asks, he says, I live in the UK where grayling are often found alongside bruin trout in our chalk streams. Are Alaska's grayling the same species that are found in the UK? An absolute trophy in the UK would be a 3-pound grayling.
Well, I didn't think we were going to get to the other species of grayling quite so quickly.
No, they are not.
No, Nick, they're not. The grayling that you find in the UK are just called grayling. They're Thalmus thalmus. They're a different species. And I remember that kind of blew me away when I first learned that as well. And so I decided, I don't know how many years ago now, that I had to see the other grayling. And so for those of you who may not be familiar with it, and many people are not, there's a wonderful international association based in England that's called the International Grayling Society. And you can just Google them and they'll come right up. And I've been a member of the Grayling Society for, I don't know, so many years I've kind of lost track. Anyway, so when I decided that I wanted to go and see this other grayling, I called the society and said, you know, where would you suggest I go to do that? And I've written for them as well, for the Grayling Journal. They is their magazine. And so, you know, I called the editor because I feel like I know him, even though we've never met, and said, well, where should I go? And I thought he would say somewhere in England. But I'm sorry, Nick, what he said was go to Sweden. That's how I first ended up going to Sweden. And I remember then, shortly after that, and I got several emails from, you know, other people that I emailed and said, oh my God, the grayling fishing in Sweden is wonderful. So pretty quick then I got a couple of emails from Swedish, like, guides, and I ended up actually getting in contact with a man who is developing fishing tourism in Sweden on a contract with the government in Swedish Lapland. And he invited me to come over and participate in a grayling tournament that he was doing there. And I did, and it was wonderful, and I've been there twice since. But when I first got in touch with him, you know, I said, I'm a little reluctant to consider coming to Sweden because I don't speak Swedish. And he emailed me back and said, that's okay. He said, for many years now, from the third grade on, Swedish children must learn English. So he said, and you may have, like, someone's child have to be a translator for you, but he said, come on over. He said, you know, and it was true. Some people say to me when I'm in Sweden, can I practice my English on you? And I say, sure, if I can practice my Swedish on you, right? But I loved Sweden, and it was like heaven sent to me. It was one of the most lucky things that have ever happened to me in all my life, was to go and see the other grayling. And so, actually, I believe you can order back copies of the Grayling Journal off of the International Grayling Society. But when I came back from my first trip, the society asked me to write an article about, you know, I'm not a biologist, although I'm going to be one in my next life. I'm going to be a fisheries biologist in my next life. I'm an honorary fisheries biologist now, but a couple of my friends in fish and game tell me. Anyway, but so I did. I said, well, you know, and I make no claims to being an expert in this, but here's what I observed was the difference between what I refer to as European grayling and Arctic grayling. The mouth on the European grayling is different, and I noticed that right away. And so in writing the book, I did some research on that to say, what is the difference? An Arctic grayling is said to have a terminal mouth. That is, its little pucker of the top and the bottom, the lip goes straight, but the European grayling does not. It has what's called a subterminal mouth, and its mouth is angled a little down. And that's what makes, of all the reading, I mean, I've read books and everything probably that's ever been written on grayling from, I don't know, in the 1800s, I have a couple of books. It's been wonderful. I've loved every minute of it. But that's why European grayling are known to be more bottom feeders than Arctic grayling are, because of the different mouth.
Like
also, I noticed that many grayling that I encountered in Sweden have a more reddish color, and not a whole lot of Arctic grayling. They'll develop a lot of different colors, but not usually sort of reddish. Yeah. And then, of course, I'm probably biased, but I didn't think that the dorsal fins on European grayling matched, large European grayling, matched those that I've seen on Arctic grayling.
Yeah. We need to take a quick break here, and then we'll come back, talk about equipment, food, flies, and strategies.
Okay.
Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Pudge Kleinkopf about fly fishing Alaska's Arctic grayling. If you'd like to ask Pudge a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and send us your question, and we'll try to answer it as soon as possible on our show tonight. All right, Pudge, we've got questions about what kind of size, weight, and rod do you suggest for grayling in Alaska?
Even though they're small fish, I ask my clients never to fish with anything smaller than a 5-weight. And that is because grayling is one of the species that the lactose, you know, the acid in their body builds up very quickly when, you know, you're playing them, and they are difficult to release. So, and many of them die because even though people say, well, I did a careful release, they simply played the fish too long. And so a 3-weight or a 4-weight rod certainly, you know, will give you lots of fun, but it's really hurtful to the fish. So I use a 9-foot 5-weight.
Okay, good tip. And do you normally use, whether you're fishing streams or lakes, are you normally using floating lines? Is there any need for intermediate sinking or sinking tip lines up there?
Well, certainly I have to say that all the fishing I do for grayling, 90% of the time I'm using a weight forward floating line, just a basic weight forward floating line. But in some of the lakes that I fish, I do on occasion use an intermediate line with a nymph or a small streamer. But in the rivers, I seldom pull out even an intermediate.
Okay, and what's your terminal tackle setup? How do you rig up?
Well, you know, unless you just really like to cast a 12 feet of leader, you don't have to. 9 to 10 foot leader usually will do you just fine. With grade down, I tie my own leaders, and I teach my client to others too. But usually I use no smaller than 5 pound test, again, because I don't want to stress the fish. So 5 or 6 pound test for a tippet.
And so they're not particularly leader shy?
No,
there?
No. They're, what makes them such a wonderful fish is they're incredible feeders. They have to be. They're so small, and they're insectivores, and so, you know, they're not real meat eaters, and like char, and so, you know, they're eating all the time. And so fly fishing for grayling is all about presentation. So if you want to go a little smaller, like a 4 pound test, you know, go ahead. But again, just remember that, you know, all of those things are going to make it a little harder for you to get them in, and so you really are stressing them.
So you just said they're insectivores, so just any bug, huh, is what they feed on?
They love bugs. They just love bugs, and they love all stages of bugs. So, you know, you can fish them with emergers, you can fish them with, they love nymphs, dry flies, yes. So they're clearly primarily insectivores. Now, in the rivers where salmon are, and many grayling are in rivers that see no salmon. They're too far from the ocean, you know, there just aren't any salmon. But where salmon, where they live in salmon rivers, they're like any other fish. They eat salmon eggs, and they will eat rotting salmon flesh. And so in that case, in that situation, then you would use the flies, you know, that we would use for, like, char or trout, egg imitations, flesh imitations. But the beauty of them is even when they live in a river where there are salmon and they're feeding on the eggs and the salmon flesh, they still feed on bugs.
Yeah.
Feed on. Now, trout won't do that. Trout won't. Trout will feed on bugs, but then as soon as the salmon are in and the eggs are there and the flesh, you're going to pay a pretty penny to try to get a trout to take a dry fly.
Yeah.
But not grayling. Grayling, like, never, like, they kind of never give up their, I call it insectivoreness.
Yeah.
So.
Now, Martin Coleman, Lawrence, Kansas, asks, what are some of the basic flies you'd have in your box when going for grayling?
Well, you know, the good word is, Martin, you said,
right.
Martin and anyone else, it's pretty much the dry flies you'd use almost anywhere else. You never leave home for grayling fishing without an Elkhair caddis, a parachute Adams, a royal wolf, and a prince nymph. The basic nymphs that you would use probably everywhere. You know, I mean, nymphs and dry flies. Yeah, parachute Adams, golden hare's ear, beads, unbeads, some beaded, some not beaded. At times, grayling just seem to go nuts over royal wolves, over small royal wolves. And, you know, that's a standard dry that people would have in their box pretty much anywhere.
Right.
Now, grayling are often, though, people forget with grayling that they're not just little bug feeders. Grayling get very opportunistic. The bigger they get, you know, and they need more sustenance to survive in the winter, they've been known when I was fishing for the big, I've done this a number of times, fishing for big Arctic char, way up, you know, almost to the North Slope. And grayling will take the fly, and these are like size 2 olive bunny flies. And the grayling will beat the char to the fly. And they're these huge flies. So, you know, don't think that they'll never take a streamer or that you'd only use streamers in lake. You do primarily use streamers and nymphs more in lakes, unless you can hit a nice hatch and, you know, see them rising on the surface. But even then, just like anywhere else, don't be fooled. They may not be taking dry flies at all. You might want to have your emergers box with you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, George in Alabama asks, you talk about opportunistic, he asks, have you ever caught one on a mouse pattern?
Actually, I have several times, George. I just don't fish, you know, the mouse patterns a lot just because I don't like to cast them mostly. But, yeah, actually, I was fishing one time in Bristol Bay, and someone said, we're going mousing. And I said, we're going to do what? I'd never heard of such a thing. Remember, I didn't grow up in Alaska. I only lived here 42 years. And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. And they said, well, come on, we'll show you. So they showed me a mouse, and all I could think of is, I am going to catch monster trout today because it's going to take a monster trout to get his mouth around that mouth, right? Yeah. And it turned out that I caught several monster grayling, as well as several monster trout. But then I also caught several grayling that were only about 14 inches long and several trout that were only about 14 inches long on this great big mouse. So, yes, mousing's great fun. As I say, I just don't probably do it as often as I should because I don't particularly like to cast them.
Yeah, yeah. Geraldo writes in, I, too, have been fascinated by Arctic grayling for at least the past 25 years, having caught them in Yellowstone National Park, high mountain lakes in both Colorado and Idaho, and in several rivers and small lakes in Alaska. I've always resorted to the tried-and-true black gnat dry fly pattern. It has rarely failed to produce grayling. However, now the trend seems to be towards brighter patterns, as well as subsurface and emerger flies. What has produced the most consistently for you over the years, and what is your go-to pattern currently?
Well, I guess if you forced me to pick one single fly, only one of any kind, that I would take with me grayling fishing, it would be an Elk Caddis. Our grayling, you know, Alaska has huge hatches of caddis. Not certainly, I'm sure, you know, to the extent that they exist in other states because it's just simply too cold here. But that is our primary dry fly fish. I mean, dry fly for fish is caddis. We have some stoneflies and some rivers. Often they're not very big. And we have mayflies occasionally. I was steelhead fishing with my son in southeastern Alaska one year, and there were beautiful mayflies all over the place. Not one rise to them. Not one. They just, some, I don't know, there just weren't a lot of trout or, you know, certainly the steelhead weren't rising to them. So it would be Elk Caddis. But, Geraldo, the other thing, having said that you're in love with the, you know, the black gnat, I was too for a while, but when I first started to learn to grayling fish, I couldn't catch them, even with a black gnat. And that was because I couldn't see it. And so my clients can't see it either. So now my clients all start with a small parachute Adams, or a small royal wolf, and those two particularly, with a white post. That's the way I sort of start my clients and get them trained to learning how to see the fly, you know, on the water. And even, well, now I'm getting old, but in this day I tie some of my black gnats with a little white post as well for the visibility.
Good for you.
So don't give up on your black gnat. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Kyle in Anchorage, Alaska, he says, often on interior streams, I find the grayling feeding on midges, yet my midge patterns are consistently outperformed by larger, flashier attractor nymphs. Have you found this to be the case, and do you have a favorite nymph pattern for when the grayling are not hitting dry flies?
Well, you know, when I find them, you know, feeding on midges, actually what they'll also feed on is emergers, almost always. But I do. I have several nymph patterns. As I say, I never leave home as well without a good old gold-ribbed hare's ear. You just can't beat it. Some of mine have beads, and some of them do not. Also, there's a number of, you know, just pretty much kind of standard nymph patterns. You know, don't get too big. About a size, actually in Alaska, about a size 12 in both a nymph or a dry fly will pretty much do you kind of no matter where you are. But, yeah, just probably, you know, a golden hare's ear or a pheasant tail. Grayling, I think, love pheasant tails as well.
Well, you really don't need anything special. Just bring your trout.
No, you really don't. I mean, certainly we have, you know, we have some, but they're really, no, the standard things that you will use, you'll use here as well.
Okay. Another quick break here, and we'll be back and talk about strategy and tactics. So stay with us, folks.
All right.
Have you dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles to classic papers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit our website at www.powerfibers.com. That's powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Pudge Kleinkopf about fly fishing for Alaska's Arctic grayling. If you'd like to ask Pudge a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. We did get a few questions in here, Pudge, from the Internet. Jerry in Helena, Montana, was asking about, he says, there's a last remnant of native Arctic grayling in the lower 48 in the Big Hole River in Montana. They are considered a threatened species. Do you know about this? I think that's what you were talking about before.
Right? Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So we've already kind of addressed that. That does exist and is something that people are trying to work with. Okay. Let's see here. Well, talking about strategies and so forth, we got a question from Jonathan in Oak Harbor, Washington, asking, do you nymph a lot for Arctic grayling? And that's what I was going to lead into, is talking about streams and rivers. So why don't you answer his question as we go through this? First, Pudge, what size streams and rivers are you going to find grayling in? Because Alaska has some massive rivers, and of course, and then some very delicate streams as well. Where are we going to find the grayling?
Well, you know, many people email me and say, you know, can I grayling fish in the Kenai River? I email back and say, no,
that's
sorry.
What I mean by big rivers.
Yeah, yeah. But no, but, and, you know, and we've got, heck, we've got the Yukon, for heaven's sake, and the Kuskokwim.
Yeah.
But you
yeah.
know what? All the tributaries to those, the Yukon and the Kuskokwim, virtually all of them have grayling.
Okay.
So you won't find them in the main river. That's just not the kind of water they'll stay in. But, you know, they're their highways. They move those to, you know, use those to move into the feeder streams and stuff where they'll be. So kind of, you can find grayling sometimes in the tiniest stream you won't believe. You won't believe. They don't stay there necessarily all the time. But if there's, you know, just happens to be really good feeding, you know, at a particular time in a particular area, they will move there. So, but just remember, they don't, they'll use the rivers, the silty rivers, you know, the glacial rivers in Alaska, to get to where they got to go. But they won't stay there. And you generally won't fish for them there either. You'll fish for them 99% of the time in the clear water streams and rivers.
Okay. And, you know, are they similar to trout? Do we look for them in the same spots that trout habitate in the streams?
Well, yes and no. Trout are more solitary fish. You don't often find, you know, a huge group of trout altogether. But grayling are not. Grayling are school fish, or schooly fish, as they're often referred to. And so if you find one grayling, don't move. You'll find a whole bunch in that same area. And they're known for it. It's in the book all about how the studies have shown that they are hierarchical. So the bigger fish are at the front of the line, the front of the drift, or the front of the run, or the head of the pool. And then the progressively smaller fish kind of line up, you know, behind the big gals and the big guys. But you will find a number of fish. And what will happen, it happens all the time when I'm fishing and on my various trips, we'll catch maybe six or eight fish and the clients, and they'll begin to get then progressively smaller. I mean, we'll keep fish, catching fish and keep catching fish, and we'll move down the run a little bit or down the drift a little bit and keep catching fish. But generally, they'll continue to get smaller and smaller. And then we probably hooked, you know, the, I call them the biters, you know, in an area, and so then we'll move to another drift. But again, one of the things about grayling that endures them to all of us is because you could stand in one spot and catch 15, 12, 15 grayling, one right after the other. Once you get an idea of where they are, you know, what the drift is, and they're not real picky on the flies, but occasionally you've got to try a couple, you know, just to find the right one.
Now, do you fish for them like trout then? I mean, are you fishing holes and runs as you would a trout?
No, not, well, yes and no. Again, grayling, trout, if you, there's a couple of great underwater videos of, you know, a trout feeding lies, I think one of them is called. It's great. And I know that you've had, I think, a couple of those people on the show in the past, Roger. But rainbows will be more spread out over the feeding area. Grayling will not. Grayling will be in this sort of hierarchical kind of line, and grayling occupy very narrow feeding lanes, very specific feeding lanes. They don't kind of, you know, if you watch the videos of an underwater trout, I mean, he'll quite a ways to the right to see something, you know, he sees coming down, and then he'll move back into his feeding pattern. They don't do that so much. Graylings stay pretty much, once you find the feeding line and the feeding drift, you got to get your fly in that to get grayling. So they're not nearly so apt to move too far away from the feeding drift like rainbows are.
So does that make them more difficult to present the fly to? Do you have to put it right on their nose then?
Yeah, well, see, I think it makes it easier because you have just to remember that the feeding lanes are fairly narrow. I mean, these are not big fish. And so once you find the feeding drift, it, pretty quick you'll experiment. You'll find when your fly is like 6 inches off the other side, and then you just have to move back a little, or, you know, not quite out far enough, and then you just have to move out a little farther. Once you can pretty well define what the feeding lane is, and just keep your dry fly or your nymph right there.
And because they're, I guess I'm reading you saying that they're compacted in that feeding lane, so you have more fish to present to?
Mm-hmm.
Is that true,
mm-hmm.
too?
And they just, you know, you just have to know, they're not going to move very far afield to get their food, because they've found the right place where the food's coming, you know, the food conveyor, and they just stay there.
So you're looking for the same kinds of feeding lanes you would for trout on seam edges and so forth.
Yes, yes.
So that's a similar part of it. But, okay.
But then the other different part is trout tend to be, and most of us know, trout tend to be in a little more turbulent water. Grayling generally aren't. Grayling don't spend too much time in the more turbulent water, unless it's way down at the bottom.
They won't be in the ripples and so forth.
No, they won't be as much in the ripples, no.
Okay, okay. What about the water temperature? You talked about that earlier.
The, you know, the kind of high 40s up to low 50s and stuff is what they really prefer. As the temperature approaches 60, forget it. They'll either hold, they'll back out and hold in one of the deep pools or something, but the big guys just, they can't really, I don't think, tolerate warmer water.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned before that they're moving based upon water temperature and the season and so forth. Like that, when you were, well, you mentioned earlier, I guess, and maybe you've already answered this, but the day you had kind of a bum day, a couple fish,
mm-hmm.
trying to figure out what's going on. If you're not getting fish, and there should be fish in that area, then do you move down or do you move up? Does that depend on the type of season?
Yeah, you just move, because the grayling will move. You just move. In other words, but before you move, look at your presentation. Grayling are very forgiving, and we love them because they're so eager, but people say, oh, they're pushovers. No, they're not pushovers. You have to do, if you've ever worked on your drag-free drift, you better work on it before you fish for grayling. The grayling, here will come a fly with the leader perpendicular to the fly, and all the fish can see that leader perfectly. You know, we sometimes can't see it. We forget it's there, but they can see it. Now, a trout will see it and leave. A grayling will see it, but he doesn't leave. That's why we love them so much. He waits. I always say he waits until us stupid humans get it right. And then he'll take the very same fly that you've been giving him for 20 minutes, and you said, he won't take it. What's the matter? I got to change the fly. No, you don't. You probably first need to change your presentation.
Okay. So what's the secret then in the presentation? Is it?
Drag-free drift.
That's
in the feeding lane. That's what it,
in the
that's,
the,
in the feeding lane.
It's going to be a narrow feeding lane. So you
yes,
get
yes,
cat,
yes.
Right.
And so you better pay attention that, you know, you just can't, you know, drift your fly anywhere out there and, you know, expect the grayling to come rushing across the stream and take it. I mean, he's not that eager, right? And he's small, so he's not going to expend that kind of energy.
Yeah.
No, he's going to stay right where he knows the food's coming from.
Yeah, yeah. Now, do they follow or tail salmon like, you know, Dolly Varden will, you know?
I mean, they do.
Caught dollies behind kings that are spawning this, you know.
Yes, and you'll see grayling there as well. Mm-hmm. You'll see grayling there as well. But as
that
I said earlier, they never really completely give up their love of bugs.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know fishing for those over there in the Togiak and those feeder, you know, the streams and so forth, and trying to float through the spawning kings so you could get to the dolly barn.
Or the trout.
Hooking up on the kings and then breaking them off quickly because you didn't really want to tangle with them. And,
yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
Spawn.
That happens
and,
all the time. Yes.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting dilemma of how to get through there. How to get through a, you know, 40-pound fish to get to.
Well, and usually, you know, we say, well, the 40-pound fish won't take the fly that you're fishing with, but it gets caught on that fish,
yeah,
big fish, just accidentally.
Exactly, yeah, you get hung up on them, yeah. Okay, you talked about probably the biggest tip is drag-free drifts in the stream. Let's talk about anything else you want to mention about stream fishing for them, and then we'll move on to talking about stillwater.
Well, yes. Those of you, like me, who may be learning check nymphing,
mm-hmm.
check nymphing was made for grayling.
Ah.
That's how grayling, check fishing got created in Poland and Czechoslovakia. One of their primary sport fish there is grayling. The guy who invented, the story goes, the guy who invented check nymphing was grayling fishing.
Mm.
And it's, again, so that's the first time I went to Sweden. That's what I discovered, was check nymphing. And I've just been nuts about it ever since. As a matter of fact, the most recent issue, I think, or the last issue of Fish Alaska magazine has my article on check nymphing Alaska in it. So, so if you're fishing a stream and you're not trying your check nymphs, you're crazy. But you have to be very careful in Alaska. Any water that's designated fly fishing only, you can only use one fly. And nowhere in Alaska, nowhere can you use more than two.
Okay.
So, okay, just totally a little tip for people who are coming to Alaska.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's talk about Lake Stillwater, differences in fishing for grayling there. Of course, we've got a different type of water. So, where do we look for them in the lake?
Well, obviously, you'd start by looking for a bunch of rises on the lake. If you know once you know they're there, if you know they're there and you don't see any rises, then I go under the water with either usually olive, golden hare's ear, and I like the little flashback ones as well, or a beadhead golden hare's ear, then usually olive, because that's the better color in a lake, I think, for almost anything, or small olive or black. We have a fly we use called a beadhead lake leech. That's just a beadhead and just marabou, and you wrap the marabou around the body, the shank of the hook, and then just let the fluffy part hang out the back end with a little bead on the front, and keep them small, keep them about size 8, 10, and both of those two patterns, and plus a small woolly bugger or beadhead woolly bugger, will be the three best. Those are the flies I use when I go underwater on lakes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, do you use nymphs much in the lakes?
Yes, but the nymph that's always produced for me the best is the olive golden hare's ear.
That's the one. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Any luck with fishing, like emergers off of dry flies in a lake, that combination?
Yes, actually some, although usually we just use one fly or the other, either the emerger or the dry. I mean, once you figure out which one is taking them, you might as well put the other one away.
Yeah, okay. Now, how important is to match the hatch for the grayling on? If you're seeing the rising fish and you're trying to put something out there for them, is it important to match the hatch?
Yeah, I think it's a little more important to match it on stillwater than in freshwater.
Okay. And again, just see what's hatching, right? Whether they're caddis or pigeons or whatever.
And if you don't have it, just then fall back, because they're always taking emergers. I mean, we all know that, no matter how many dives they're taking, there's still some of the bunch of fishes that's still taking the emergers.
Yeah, yeah. Do they, and then maybe to your searching patterns like the Adams or Royal Wolf or something like that as well, right?
Yes, and often just, if they go down in size, that sometimes works for me too.
Okay, pick those up.
It may not be so much the fly as it is the size.
Yeah. We're getting short on time here, but we do have some questions about trip planning. Maybe you could just, there's a question from Nick in London, Mary in Seattle. I've got one online from Duke in Ithaca, New York. All wanting to know if they were going to take a trip to Alaska. You've already said that the Bristol Bay area is a great place to send them. Any other suggestions on one of their concerns is the cost-effective way. Of course, the further back in you go, the more expensive it gets, I think, in Alaska.
But, like any other trip and for any other fish, that's where the best fishing is going to be. So I always recommend to people, better to save your money and take a trip and do it right, than to make four trips where, you wish you'd have caught the big one, but you're in a stream where people kill them, and so all you're going to get is like 10 inches.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
But certainly, you know, once you get up beyond Anchorage and out of Anchorage, you know, heading north and west, you'll find more and more and more grayling. And they'll be in the streams, you know, or a lot of the streams anyway, that, you know, are near the road or crossing the road or whatever. Now, in my book, a whole section of my book, one third probably of the book, is on where to go in Alaska. And so I started out, but I very quickly gave up the effort to try to, you know, categorize every single where you could get grayling. You know, at one point I thought, I can't write a grayling book until I have fished everywhere in Alaska that grayling are, until I learned that it would take you like six lifetimes to do that. So, but the Department of Fish and Game in Alaska has wonderful little, you know, little booklets and pamphlets where they'll tell you, you know, what's in which stream and where. And if you're coming to Alaska, buy the Alaska Milepost. You can get it off of Amazon, and it goes mile by mile everywhere you can drive, and it's got little fish symbols for where there's fishing. And then when you read, it'll tell you what fish are there. So do not come to Alaska ever without the Alaska Milepost.
That's been around since I was a kid in Alaska.
It has been around probably since you were a kid in Alaska. And it's still, you know, many people, when I say to them, well, you could find that in your milepost, and they say, where? And I say, well, just look at the mile and look for the little fishy symbol. Oh, they say, they don't even notice the little fishy symbol. So, yes.
Yeah.
So that's actually a very good way. And then, as I said, my book will give you some of the, I tried to do a good smattering, a good cross-section of the rivers in different, we had a hard time kind of, you know, putting the state into, like, geographic areas. But so we just did a sort of an arbitrary way, and then put a lot of the good rivers in that particular area. And we tried to cover the whole state. So so with those two things, and then you should be able to see where they are.
Yeah. One thing that, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I don't think I am, but, you know, I lived up there when I was a kid in Anchorage, and we used to fish a place called Bird Creek, which is like 45 minutes outside of Anchorage, and my dad and I used to be the only two people on that stretch of river.
Yep.
Last time I was up there, it was elbow-to-elbow fishing. So needless to say, if you're looking for really great fishing in Alaska, you're not going to find it off the road from Anchorage. You're going to have to get away because it's just too accessible nowadays compared to what it used to be.
Or if you want it off the road, park and hike.
Hike, yeah. It doesn't take long to get away in Alaska to where you're in a pretty primitive area rather quickly, but you really have to go to the other side of the trees to find some really good fish.
But watch the regs, because in many places, all of those people are concentrated in one spot because you can't fish upstream of a certain marker or something.
Yeah, like,
so like everywhere,
creek,
market.
Yeah,
you know, you do the same thing you do anywhere. Just,
sure.
You know, look at your regs and pay attention. You don't want to get busted. Especially you don't want to get busted in Alaska, because now the law permits them to confiscate all your fishing gear, including, guess what, your boat, and in a few cases even, they've confiscated airplanes and vehicles. You don't want to get busted in Alaska. Trust me, you don't. So that's your legal advice. That's your legal advice, yes. Don't get busted in Alaska.
Well, good, Pudge. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, and we got to wrap things up here, but stick with me here, Pudge. We're going to give away your book here in a few minutes, and everybody else will stick with us, too. We're going to give away that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine as well. So hang tight. We'll do that in just another minute. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing anywhere, and now we know some of the best grayling fishing anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry has united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit www.savebristolbay.org and learn more about how to get involved. It's savebristolbay.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section of tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. Now it's time to give away our prizes, and our winners are randomly drawn from our registration database. And If you are one of the winners, then we will contact you and about getting your information and getting you your prize. So the first thing that we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, International Organization for Fly Fishing, and it's find more out about them at fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. And our winner there is going to be Al Laurent in Oklahoma. So Al Laurent in Oklahoma, and congratulations, Al. I know you'll enjoy this. If you're already a member, we'll get your membership extended for you, and a great organization to support and be a member of. Now, our second gift is a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, wonderful magazine, great photography and graphics in this, and that's going to Ashik Ray Aman. Ashik Ray Aman, and he's in New York. So, Ashik, congratulations on winning that subscription. And let me just jot down his name here. And I know you'll enjoy that. And if other people are interested in getting a subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, go to flyfusionmag.com. Flyfusionmag.com. Okay, now we get to give away Pudge's most recent book, Fly Fishing for Alaska's Arctic Grayling. And then you'll get to see all those beautiful pictures, right, Pudge?
Oh, right.
In this book. Mm-hmm. Yeah, excellent pictures. So what you need to do is go to our homepage and type in the answer to the question I'm going to ask in just a couple of seconds. And be sure you put in who you are and where you're from. And if you answer this correctly, then you get Pudge's book. And this isn't going to be too hard tonight. The question is, if you were going to look for, go fishing for a trophy grayling in Alaska, what area did Pudge say to go first to? What area is that? So let's see what we got here, Pudge, and see if anybody's
okay.
Listening. I'm checking here as they're madly typing.
Mm-hmm. Trying to beat
usually,
everybody else.
Yeah, well, somebody tries to anticipate the question, so I say, what area, and I get Adams. you sent that before I asked the question. So. Okay, this first one is not there. Here we go. I think we got a winner. This person says Bristol Bay. Is that it?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Randy Black in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Just got yourself a copy of Pudge's latest book, so congratulations. Now, Randy, to get that book, you're going to have to send me your name and address and email address as well to either in the same box you just sent the answer to the question or to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com. And then we'll get Amato Books to send that book out to you directly from their publishing company there. So thanks to Amato Books again for offering up that book tonight. And, Pudge, thanks for writing the book. That's great.
Well, you're welcome. Can I tell people who didn't win the book tonight who would still like to have it?
Sure.
They can order it off of my website.
Sure.
Well, or at Amato Books or on you know, anywhere. The website
sure.
is www.womensflyfishing.net.
And I bet if you order it from Pudge, you get it autographed. Don't
you bet. Absolutely,
okay.
You do.
So there you go. There you go. There's some incentive for you to order from Pudge's website. So thanks, Pudge, for telling us about that. And thanks for being on our show tonight again. And really enjoyed it. And time passed way too quickly. But I had fun. I hope everybody else did.
I certainly did. Thanks for asking me.
Well, good. Good. We enjoyed your company. And thanks for sharing your knowledge. Our next broadcast will be on February 2nd, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern, and on that show we're going to interview Gary Borger, and our topic for the show will be Fly Fishing the Film. Gary Borger will cover the skills necessary for successfully fly fishing the film. You can learn from him his secrets on increasing your odds and hooking up at the surface. And this interview is going to be based on a lot of research he just did on his most recent book, Fishing the Film. So hope to see you then. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. Think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows? Give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. And we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.